From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Just before the regime of Hosni Mubarak was ushered out by the Egyptian military, he issued a stern instruction to his people, essentially, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. What he said was, don't watch satellite news. His vice president, Omar Suleiman, repeated the command, turn it off.
Satellite television stations whose main purpose is to fuel sedition and drive a wedge among the people and to tarnish the image of people. Only listen to your own conscience.
What they meant was, ignore the evidence of your own eyes and ears, your tweets and YouTube videos, your Facebook posts. Pay no attention to the coverage of Al Jazeera and the rest of the world's media broadcasting from the square. In the early days of the uprising, state media was offering fabricated accounts of Mubarak's great and powerful hold on his nation, downplaying the unrest. Earlier still, Omar Suleiman even suggested that the demonstrators had been infected by foreign notions.
It's not their idea. It comes from abroad.
But despite the threats, the violence, the camels and horses charging, the Molotov cocktails hurled, the popular movement proved an immovable object. And slowly, the government started losing its grip, even on the domestic media, as some journalists resigned from their comfortable jobs and joined the protesters.
Today, we received the news that the prominent anchor and senior correspondent, the deputy head of the state-run Nile TV, the English language satellite channel, decided to hand in her resignation.
It was a spur of the moment decision. I was heading to work as usual, and the state television building is not far from Tahrir Square, and I heard the chants of the protesters and decided to get off in Tahrir Square and join the protesters because I'm siding with the people, not the regime.
And just when it seemed that the demonstrators in the square might be losing heart, a media hero emerged to reinvigorate them.
Remarkably today, Egyptian state television played it straight. It reported today's protests and the release of Wael Gonin, a Google executive jailed as a Mubarak critic.
That was Gonin speaking in an interview on a private Egyptian TV channel. He'd just been released after having been abducted by the authorities and held for 12 days, blindfolded the whole time. When he saw pictures of the dead protesters, he wept as he thought of his father's suffering when he vanished without a trace. Gonin had created the Facebook page that first galvanized many of the protesters. The internet did not cause this revolution, but it provided the tools its young leaders needed to write its narrative. In fact, as one young protester told the BBC, Mubarak and Suleiman were unreachably out of touch. These men, said the protester, had never even sent an email. But even the media Mubarak did understand and had long controlled broke free and started to write their own story.
Even at Al Ahram, the government's main newspaper, reports of open revolt there, a sign perhaps that at least a portion of the government propaganda machine may be cracking.
This seemed to be the final straw for Mubarak. Once he'd lost control of the message, he had no strength, nothing to show the military that he would ever regain it. So the military moved in.
For news of revolution leading up to the events of this Friday, the last place Egyptians would think to look was Al Ahram, the country's largest daily newspaper and one of its most venerable. Al Ahram is owned by a foundation controlled by the state and, as such, has for decades been friendly to the Mubarak regime. But in the past 5 years, under the editorship of Mubarak crony Osama Saraya, Al Ahram has developed into a propaganda machine, devoting hagiographic and occasionally utterly fabricated coverage to the former president and his regime. That's why many were shocked this week when Al Ahram somehow rediscovered its journalistic soul and reported honestly on the revolution in progress. The day before Mubarak stepped down, I spoke to Gamal Zaida, managing editor of Al Ahram. He told me that this marks the beginning of a long road back to credibility for his paper.
We have been suffering from lack of credibility for the last few years. We had great writers working for Al Ahram, but they had to leave the newspaper under the pressures coming from the chief editor.
And that's Osama Saraya.
Exactly. The guy is not a professional journalist, not efficient, but has been appointed because of his relation with the presidential institution. And he was doing the propaganda. I didn't do that myself. I always criticize the government, but the guy is very well paid, even more than the editor of the New York Times or the Washington Post. And that's why he is justifying what is he doing in an unethical way.
In the early days of the uprising, with hundreds of thousands of people on the streets in Tahrir Square and violence breaking out and thuggery attacking demonstrators, your newspaper was reporting that there were perhaps 4,000 or 5,000 people in the square and that they were mostly the agents of the foreign press. What were the editorial deliberations at Al-Ahram in printing those lies in the paper?
That was because of the editor himself pressing everybody. You know, he himself was responsible for that, not his colleagues. In fact, the first day of uprising, he instructed the editors to have the main headline like millions of Egyptians rally behind Mubarak, which was false.
The opposite of reality.
Yes, unfortunately.
Before the events of January 25th, page one in Al-Ahram had become the Hosni Mubarak fan page.
Most of the days, unless there is a natural disaster or there is wars somewhere in the world or a very, very, very big news story, which we cannot avoid. The president himself considered Al-Ahram his own newspaper, reflecting his news, reflecting his policies, defending his policies, and so on.
The most famous example of using Al-Ahram to represent the interests came when President Mubarak was visiting President Obama in Washington, and your editor doctored a photograph. In the actual photograph, President Mubarak is lagging behind the President of the United States and other dignitaries. As it appeared in Al-Ahram, President Mubarak was in the foreground, appearing to lead the group. It's incredible.
This is something should not happen. It was a fatal ethical mistake made by the editor. I mean, he was flattering his boss. That's why he doctored the photo. And it was a big scandal worldwide.
Why did it take till now to stage a mutiny against Osama Saraya and the heavy hand of the state?
In fact, we had fighting regarding the editing policy for many, many years. I mean, many people refused this editorial policy, but if someone said no, they will fire him or her. But many people, they don't have the margin to move to have a job in some other newspapers, like in the United States or in UK or in any Western democracies. So if someone has been fired, he will be in the street, so it will be difficult to earn his living.
Can you tell me what was the moment when you and your colleagues decided at long last to assert yourselves?
After the 25th of January, and what's happening in the street in Tahrir Square, and the revolution of the youth everywhere in Egypt, the journalists in Al-Ahram decided to stop the previous editing policy.
The expression here is the straw that broke the camel's back. When did it finally become too much? Was there a moment in the newsroom?
Yes, when the journalists and reporters see that the whole country in a revolution and the editor-in-chief insisting to change the reality. And that's why they protested and they said, no, enough is enough. I'm one of them. We cannot do it. I mean, we have to reflect the reality. We cannot lie.
And what happened? Did Saraya storm
out? He had to back
off.
He had to back off since then.
Is he there now? I mean,
yes.
Is he still sitting in his office?
Yes, he is in his office, but the colleagues are running the newspaper the way they see, according to the right journalistic values.
How can you assure me that you and the colleagues who have finally taken a stand are not just opportunists blowing with the political winds.
Why you call them opportunists? I mean, this newspaper doesn't belong to Hosni Mubarak or just a specific person. It's the right time for journalists to dismantle the relation between these newspapers and the regime, to start applying the ethics of free journalism and stop deceiving the readers.
This is a difficult question to ask, but I have to ask it. Over the last 5 years, have you yourself personally been a collaborator, at least by not resigning in the face of horrible ethical trespasses?
We had many fights, with the management regarding the editorial policy, regarding the censorship, regarding not to let many writers and journalists to run their stories on the newspaper. We had a very big meeting today with the chairman. He is different from the editor-in-chief. And 300 journalists were discussing with him the future of the newspaper and how not to repeat what happened again, to restore our dignity, our pride, our professional values as it was before. I mean, these millions of young men and women, they went to the streets and they made the revolution. Everybody, since the day one, they knew that this is the end of the regime. That's it.
Gamal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gamal Zaida is managing editor of Al Ahram.
Coming up, the soundtrack of the Middle East youth movement.
This is On the Media.
سيد الرئيس نكتب لك لأول خطرة مملكة عن بالية الخطوة خطيرة.
Support for On the Media comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. The Kauffman Foundation, working to advance innovations in education and entrepreneurial success. Learn more at kauffman.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Hello, podcast listeners. On the Media is having its first live event on Tuesday, February 15th at 7. If you're in the New York area, you can probably still get a ticket, but they're going fast. All you have to do is go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. That's G-R-E-E-N-E space. But if you're not in the area, you can actually watch a live webcast. That'll be at 7 on February 15th. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In 2009, in response to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's first speech to the United Nations, a group of Libyan exiles created an organization called Khalas, which means enough. The goal, to bring awareness of the struggles against Libya's dictatorial regime, not only to other Libyans in the Western world, but to the English-speaking world at large. In the wake of revolution in Tunisia and Egypt and protests elsewhere in North Africa and the Middle East, the Khalas team recognized one surprising common thread in the voices of discontent: rap music. Across the region, rap artists were providing the soundtrack to protests in the street. Khalas has curated a mixtape of some of the best new protest music and is now hosting the mix on its website, EnoughGaddafi.com. Abdullah Darat is one of the founders of Khalas. Abdullah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by just listening to some Arabic hip hop. La jeunesse tfakker ghir fi ddebar khatak la plupart chef w mustaqbel koul ttab w shbqat ki taqra omrek. All right, it's kind of hard for me to relate to that, partly because my Arabic is a little thin and also because I'm old. So, what have we just heard?
In this part of the song, we have one of the legends of North African hip-hop. His name is Lutfi Doublekan, who's an Algerian hip-hop artist who's been rhyming since the early 90s. And in this song, he's writing a letter to Bouteflika, who is the president of Algeria. And he's not attacking him. What he's doing is he's trying to reason with him. He's saying to him, listen, I'm not here swinging swords. I'm not here bringing you gossip from a newspaper. I'm not here trying to set a new fire. I'm here to give you a message from the youth. And that youth sees their future as bleak and they see that the people standing in power are there because of nepotism or people who are in those positions have bought into those positions. And if you don't do something about that, you're going to have problems.
Now, you are a part of the Libyan diaspora,
yeah.
And no rapper would take the risk of giving Muammar Gaddafi that kind of heads up and putting his name on it, right?
Of course.
I mean, that's a one-way ticket to prison.
In Libya, the situation internally is different than in some of the surrounding areas, which is what presents more challenges to the calls for protest inside the country, where there is no organized internal opposition inside of Libya. All are headquartered outside the country. Meanwhile, what you do have on the inside is individuals speaking with their voice, and they have suffered jailings, executions, other types of brutality. The artist that we have on the CD, his name is Ibn Thabit, who is the only one who is anonymous. We only know him through his pseudonym. The title to the song is Hedef al-Asasi, which means the principal objective. And in this song, he kind of outlines his theory, basically, on how change will happen in Libya. يتحمل هدف يشد العدوى يتألم أمل يتحدى خطوة ثاني سلف السيلة في إيدي لغصها إن شاء الله. And what he says, and he's playing off the word of Islah, a word on a lot of people's tongues, which is about reform. And he says, the person who wants reform needs to start with himself. He also refers a lot to the role that he thinks Islam, in his case, should play in that. And not in the kind of stereotypical way that Westerners tend to think about Islam as a thing that suffocates and represses, but in a way that liberates.
Well, let me ask you about that, because as the West observes what's happening in the Arab world right now, there's a deep ambivalence because, of course, everybody is always delighted to see an authoritarian, corrupt, repressive regime collapse. There's always the fear of the bogeyman Islamism and the worry that the new Tunisia, the new Egypt, someday the new Libya will be just larger, better armed versions of Hezbollah and Hamas and Iran. What is that notion of Islam that is threaded through this rap music, if it somehow represents a wide swath of Arab youth?
In each artist, you really start to see the specificities of the place that he's from. For example, in Libya and Tunisia and Algeria, countries that are overwhelmingly Muslim, there's a lot of reference to Islam. In the Egyptian songs, the artists refer to Islam, but at the same time, for example, Ahmed Rock in one of the songs on the mixtape, he says that this country is for Christians and Muslims alike. And that, I think, is what we saw in these youth movements, particularly in Egypt, maybe one of the most beautiful and poetic displays of civil disobedience. Christians defending Muslims as they stop to pray, or neighborhoods organizing in order to defend themselves. One of the reasons why radicalism continues to fester in these parts of the world is not necessarily because the people feel that way, but because even when they get out in the street and they protest and they do everything right, we saw that all thwarted by outside forces. The whole world's eyes were on Egypt. They saw in a few days the horror that has been the reality of people in this region for years. We saw everything that is wrong with these countries. We saw the corruption, the thugs were paid after all. We saw the treachery. They were Egyptians, weren't they? Everybody knew who they were. But that doesn't matter. The regime is interested in showing people that it can make the dog do tricks. And the more that Western powers and the more that forces inside the country continue to throw up barriers against that type of peaceful protest or that type of solidarity, the more they will radicalize people. And the hip-hop artists and the mixtapes, they talk a lot about that. And what their songs talk about are the way that Islam can make a person more honest, more loving to, more caring for his fellow citizenry.
How do the artists disseminate their messages? Can they sell CDs? Are they? They're not on the radio, are they?
All the ones that we've presented are on Facebook. They also put out YouTube videos of their songs. I'm sure a lot of people saw the YouTube video of El General Raïs El Bled after he was arrested in Tunisia. His video went viral and a lot of people heard his music, and it kind of catapulted him into a really powerful voice in his country. رئيس البلاد رئيس البلاد هاني اليوم نحكي معاك باسمي واسم الشعب الكل اللي عايش في الاحزاب 2011 ما زال فما شكون يموت بالجوع. He's back, and two of the songs that we have on the album are post his release. His following seems to be growing regularly, as do a lot of the other MCs that we presented, because they do very successfully put into words a lot of the sentiments that young people in the area are carrying with them, and they're voicing really the struggle of everyday people. We heard on February 2nd there were calls for protests in Syria, and nothing happened. And a lot of people have been talking about why that's been the case. And some theories suggest that the reason that people didn't get out on the streets is because the calls for protests weren't giving people tangible things with which they can oppose the regime. They were talking about more religious issues rather than talking to people about the ways that they struggle every day. And you see how, say, for example, in Libya, you see how billions of dollars are pouring into this country. Don't you think it's unjust that the average Libyan, 30% of them are unemployed, infrastructure, public services are subpar? Isn't that unfair? Instead of talking to people about a very abstract set of ideas, these MCs give people those kind of kernels. That kind of tangible criticism goes a long way in terms of sparking people's interest and giving them really a voice.
What are the chances that the expression of rage that you hear in North African hip-hop is going to result in any kind of political change in the region?
I think these are cultural forces. These aren't political forces. These are young people who are using their skills, their talents, to not only make others aware, but give people a set of ideas. You know, like in Rami Dunjiwan's song, Dud al-Hukuma, which means against the government, he basically just gives us a laundry list of grievances. He's saying, I'm against the government, I'm against the ruler, and I'm against its authority. I'm against bullying, and I'm against oppression, and the rope of injustice is long. I'm against the government, and I have 1,000 reasons. And then he lists them. He says, your blood, they've been spilling it. Your religion, they've been targeting it. Your portion of this world, they've swallowed it. What the world really needs to understand about the struggle in these regions is there is a youth that has hope. They have optimism about the future, but they see a lot of obstacles in their way. Obstacles that are internal, in that the people that they see who are kind of ruining that potential of the youth are ruining it through corruption, first and foremost. And they see outside forces who continue to intervene.
You put this mixtape together about a week ago as the events in Cairo were just beginning to come to a head. But I wonder whether the Libyan rapper, Ibn Thabit, has not only been further emboldened to rhyme about hopelessness and despair, but to actually foment revolution.
In the song of Su'al, which we have on the album, the title means The Question. He says, my friend, you asked me a question and I'm still confused about it. And the question is, will Libyans stand up like we saw in Tunisia? And he goes on to say, these are the reasons why we should. And I know ultimately it may not be next week, it may not be the week after that, but it will happen. One day it will happen.
Abdullah, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Abdullah Darat is a founder of Khalas. قاعد حاير من سوالك يا صاحبي العزيز توقعنا مظاهرات ما شفنا غير التنقيز شن تقول يا بن ثابت على قلوب الشعب هل مازال في امل في طموح الشعب هل سيقاوم الاعداء.
The Middle East is not the only region roiling with generational strife. In Italy, grown kids have been recently slammed by a politician as bambuccioni, big babies living in the comfort of home until marriage. Sounds cozy. It's not. It's a country with one of the oldest populations in Europe. It's also a country with an extremely high unemployment rate of young people. And that's been the source of long simmering resentment. As Megan Williams reports, that resentment is causing a widening gap between generations, both on the streets and in the press.
The sound of student marches in Rome this fall. Week after week, young people took to the streets to protest cuts to education and the lack of opportunity for young people in Italy. It's a scene that's common throughout Europe, yet young protesters in Italy perhaps have the most to complain about. Within Europe, Italy has the highest number of idle young people, 1 in 5 between ages 15 and 29, doing essentially nothing. The pessimism is pretty apparent in recent polls. More than half of Italians aged 25 to 34 would leave Italy if they could. But pessimism doesn't mean passivity. Blogs, books, and websites have popped up. pointing their fingers directly at their elders.
We lived in Italy for 20 or 30 years with people that ate all the cake and thought nothing about what was the need for the future.
Mario Adinolfi is the publisher and editor of the newly founded magazine called The Week, which is
written by all people born after 1970. In Italy, young people, they always tell us that we are young, even if I'm nearly 40 years old.
Adinolfi is a poker player. Last year, he won a big windfall and decided to invest it in a magazine devoted to fighting for the rights of Italy's under 40s. On one cover are the headshots of four leading politicians with the headline, "You're all old." On another is a glib-looking Silvio Berlusconi with the even harsher headline, "He never dies."
Because they're old. Silvio Berlusconi is 75 years old. Umberto Bossi is 70 years old. Gianfranco Fini is 60 years old, but is in politics since 40 years. And the same from Massimo D'Alema, the leader of left-wing party, 62 years old, 40 years in politics.
Adinolfi says these older politicians, bankers, and journalists have formed a kind of geriocracy that ensures its generations secure jobs, hefty pensions, and housing, while shutting out Italy's under 40s from positions of power, cutting education, and shrinking their pension prospects. Adinolfi has voiced his critique on Italian TV to the ire of older journalists. In this talk show, the editor of a leading right-wing newspaper said someone should beat him up. One of the accusations that the older generation throws in the face of younger Italians is that they're too comfortable for their own good. They point to the fact that 68% of Italians under 40 still live with their parents. Many more are financially helped out. Adinolfi, who struggled to leave home at 18, concedes there's truth in the accusation. But he says the loving Italian family can in fact be a kind of juvenile prison.
Because if you say to people that are 35 or 38, look, your parents are stealing your future, they always answer you, what are you saying? They're doing everything for me. They pay for me. And they don't understand that that is the way parents control the other half of the country.
Giovani con pochi soldi e senza tutele. È la nuova sortita del ministro Brunetta a proposito di bamboccioni.
Bamboccioni, or big babies. That's what Italy's Minister of Innovation, Renato Brunetta, called his country's young people.
I said I wanted to pass a law that would force young people to leave home at 18, and all hell broke loose, both on the left and on the right. The left criticized me, saying the issue wasn't kids staying home, but jobs. The right cried, no, you must keep families together. They're all hypocrites.
People like Mario Adinolfi shot back, pointing out that Brunetta himself lived at home until he was 30, with his mother making his bed every day. What triggered the whole debate was a court case in northern Italy, where a 33-year-old woman sued her father for support and won. Brunetta says blaming the older generation or forcing them to pay is a cop-out.
It's useless to blame the older generation for having power. Young people have to take power by leaving home, by starting careers, by innovation, by being young and modernizing. But no one's going to give it to you. You have to fight for it.
Dance instructor Marina Casagranda has fought for it. Tonight, in the small city of Trento in the Italian Alps, she's teaching a class of six-year-olds. Tomorrow, she'll work all day in a dress shop before heading home to her tiny studio apartment to finish sewing some outfits for a little more money. She makes less than $1,000 a month.
Okay.
I've also worked part-time, and after high school I worked too. Okay, I've never earned very good money as a sales clerk, and I've always had to rely partly on my mother, but I've always worked and I continue to work.
Casagranda is the 33-year-old who sued her father for support and got lacerated in the press.
The Italian media depicted me as someone who stayed at home doing nothing all day and who was out partying every night, having a great time when in reality I was working.
Editorials from the U.S. to Australia mocked and scorned Casagranda as an example of all that's wrong with today's youth: lazy, unrealistic, and overindulged. What didn't get out in the press was that Casagrande was actually suing her father for back support. He was obliged to pay her single mother while Casagrande was still a teenager, a meager $150 a month over several years. Casagrande needed the money for a back operation that her mother couldn't afford to pay. Journalists didn't bother to check the facts. Instead, they presented a narrative that vilified young people. Back in Rome, Mario Adinolfi is busy planning the next issue of his magazine. As a father of a baby, he looks tired, but also invigorated, energized by his new project. But he says in an Italy that suffocates its young people, he's an exception.
Young people can innovate. Everywhere happens things like that. There is always a 20-year-old Mark Zuckerberg that gets out and creates something. In Italy, you can't even imagine to do something like that. You stay home and you have to just understand that if you stay in the condition that your parents decide you to stay, it's much more easier. But this kills the country.
It hasn't killed it yet, though, as more young people like Adinolfi are hitting back.
Now something is happening because you see a lot of rage in the streets, but I don't think that politics and newspapers and social conditions and intellectual people in this country are understanding what's happening or what's going to happen in some years.
By then, though, they may not be around to see it. For On the Media, I'm Megan Williams in Rome.
Coming up, scandals both real and not so real, and a healthy side effect of tabloid tales.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. Last week, our interview with a researcher who found the phrase Arab street problematic and often associated with negative words drew a strong response. Some listeners hear it as a purely neutral phrase signifying public opinion in the region. But others agreed that it was pejorative, suggesting some monolithic view where none exists. Gigi Gordon of Marquette, Michigan says that's why he finds the phrase the heartland cringeworthy. Quote, the phrase conjures up the famous New Yorker map of the U.S. with nothingness between the two coasts. The phrase, to me, suggests that the speaker views the people of the heartland as a monolithic group of quaint folk who can their own vegetables and listen only to country music. Where exactly is the heartland? And do any of you cringe when you hear the phrase?
Also, last week we discussed how cable news was calling on non-experts to comment on events in Egypt, Pete Dominic among them. Several of you found our characterization of Dominic as a comedian unfair. Jan Ahrens wrote in to say that although Dominic does stand-up comedy, he also hosts a daily politics show on Sirius Radio and has spent, quote, a portion of nearly every broadcast day enlightening the listeners with guests and high-level discussions on the Egypt crisis. Pete is a comic, writes Ahrens, but that's not at all the sum total of what Pete is.
In our recent show devoted to the future of the newspaper, Yochai Benkler said that though we may not need newspapers, we do need the ability to extract information from powerful entities against their will. So we will need some form of leak extraction or preservation mechanism. But he says we may not need professional journalists to do it. A network of private individuals could serve the purpose. Edmund Feingold of Illinois disagrees. He wrote that non-professionals have very little legal protection that would enable them to preserve the anonymity of their sources, who may be, quote, exposed to a great deal more public scrutiny, perhaps harassment and or prosecution. The damage may be that fewer will come forward with leaks if they are at risk of being identified and harassed. This seems to me a potentially severe blow to our freedom of speech and the liberty of journalism in a free society.
Speaking of anonymity, you listeners have already gotten 74 senators to confirm that they did not put the anonymous hold on the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, which was killed at the end of the last Congress. Some have written to say we are being naive in our effort to identify the one who did place the hold, but legislators are loath to lie to their constituents, and the names do become known eventually. Please go to our website and click on Blow the Whistle to see if your senator is on the list. If not, call his or her office. We have the numbers. And, of course, keep writing us at onthemedia@wnyc.org.
This month, a group of anti-abortion activists called Live Action tried to catch Planned Parenthood in wrongdoing on camera. A couple, posing as a pimp and a prostitute, solicited advice on how to get medical treatment for underage prostitutes without exposing themselves to prosecution. They got it.
Everything's confidential. They don't have to tell anybody what it is that they do when they make an appointment.
Basically, these activists followed a script written in 2009 by two conservative activists who, disguised as a pimp and a prostitute, solicited advice from ACORN, a group of organizations that advocated for the poor on how to get help while evading punishment for their crimes, most notably underage sex trafficking and tax evasion. They got it.
The type of business or service you provide, let me make sure there's a code for it, okay?
A code for prostitution?
Well,
conservative gadfly Andrew Breitbart posted the ACORN videos on his website, biggovernment.com, where they migrated first to conservative news outlets like Fox and then to less ideological media. In the ensuing scandal, ACORN lost its federal funding and eventually folded. But the Planned Parenthood sting hasn't caught the attention of the media or of politicians with anything like the power of the ACORN videos. Slate's Dave Weigel wrote about these two cases, and he thinks he knows why. Dave, welcome to On the Media.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, broadly speaking, what's the difference between the two cases? They seem exactly the same.
ACORN had a completely tattered public image. It was known, I think, by the man on the street as an organization that was accused of helping people register to vote fraudulently. Planned Parenthood is, as we all know, a very successful but controversial birth control and abortion organization. There are facts on the ground that look better for Planned Parenthood. In Roanoke, where one of these stings happened, the Planned Parenthood staffer listened to this faux pimp explain his problems, and the staffer followed him out to the parking lot trying to get the license plate of his car to report him. So these stings basically completed on January 15th, and on January 18th, Planned Parenthood, having already been in contact with some law enforcement, sent a letter to the Justice Department saying somebody had been coming to their offices and asking for these things. The argument of conservatives was that this organization will give advice to anyone and they won't even report crimes. Well, they were. And liberals are primed to defend it for stuff like this. A large group of liberal organizations decided that whenever a sting like this emerges, they need to create enough of a doubt about what's in these videos that it's difficult for the media to cover them.
I think it's kind of interesting that groups that were unaffiliated with media or Planned Parenthood participated, groups like the Sierra Club or the Service Employees International Union, basically just liberal establishment groups. How did they get involved?
They're on war footing. I talked to members of these groups. They really feel like there is almost a spinning wheel of smears. They know that the conservative establishment, you know, grassroots activists all the way up to big organizations, want to defund them. They believe if they can make these groups toxic, they can destroy them the way ACORN was destroyed. But what happened wasn't just that liberals became better at fighting this. I mean, some of the other conservative stories didn't really pan out. Andrew Breitbart's tape of Shirley Sherrod, which, you know, he didn't come up with first. He ran the tape.
She's the Agriculture Department staffer who was talking about how she was initially resistant to the pleas of a white farmer and then realized they were on the same side and she needed to help them. It was a story of her own personal redemption when she understood that she was there to help everybody. And they only took the first half of the story and completely distorted it.
That's what happened. And the reaction to that, I think, was very clarifying for liberal groups and the media and conservative groups. If you remember, the NAACP initially condemned Shirley Sherrod, But when it was discovered that people had just not taken the time to go through the whole tape and see what she'd said, there was a realization that you don't need to question the motives of everyone who's doing this, but amateur journalism leads to mistakes and there's not the same quality control.
So let's just assume that in many cases, these tapes do not really show a true picture of what's going on. Acorn was defunded anyway. Could these Planned Parenthood videos, you think, significantly damage that organization?
Well, this video has been promoted as part of a coordinated effort to pass bills that make it impossible to fund birth control and abortion. There's a pretty apparent pincher strategy to get extra heat on Planned Parenthood as these bills are being debated in the House of Representatives. The difference is that I think this is actually adding some smoke and some distraction instead of some ballast to the campaign to defund abortion, to redefine abortion.
So you think it may actually have a kind of backfire effect?
The House was already going to be debating pretty strict pro-life legislation. Because the sting's happening, there's another story out there, which is conservative activists are recording videos of questionable integrity and questionable heft. And the fact that it's failing to get traction is going to be harmful. You know, if you shoot an elephant, you have to kill it. Instead, this is just reminded, I think, people in the media that activist journalism comes with a ton of risks. And it's reminded liberals that there's a threat of right-wing activist journalism that they need to spend more time combating.
So assuming that this isn't the end of candid camera activism, what do you think the next would-be video stinger needs to do to make his or her scandal resonate the way the scandal, the Acorn scandal, did?
I think as attractive as the pimp and prostitute gambit is, it needs to be something more original. It's tough to get reporters quite as interested in a pure sequel. So I think if this fails, it's because it was actually, for all of the flash, a bit lazy. There needs to be a more innovative way of exposing what these left-wing groups do with your money in a way that makes people angry, as opposed to a bit confused. The test is just whether you're exposing something that's real or you're just trying to bring them down for an ideological purpose. Mm-hmm. I think that's the problem that a lot of people in the press, post Shirley Sherrod, post all that, have with videos like this. Again, it's not as if Planned Parenthood is in the habit of giving whatever a pimp and a prostitute wants. It's that these activists thought that was a good way to trap them.
We're about to speak to a political science professor who's argued that political scandals in general are not entirely bad. Research suggests that it makes people pay more attention to the news, not just scandal news, but also policy news. Do you think there's an argument that these kinds of manufactured scandals have a place?
I think that's hard to deny. Howard Dean, when he was chairman of the DNC, told the journalist Ari Berman that he actually kind of liked it when the media would cover a spat between him and Rahm Emanuel. When he was running the DNC, Democrats were always criticizing him, and he said, I like it because reporters don't actually want to cover policy, but they cover fights, and if they cover the fight, they have to cover the policy. And there's definitely a part of that here. This is why it's kind of a mixed bag for pro-life and pro-choice activists. Abortion is an issue that both sides have trouble getting taken seriously because the political debate's kind of ossified. It's a play that's not very interesting. These stories, even if they're not getting quite the same pickup, are interesting and sensational and are a way to start talking about the way that the policy works. It's not the best news for live action if this ends up sparking more of a discussion about what Planned Parenthood does right. But there's really often no other way to talk about government funding and issues like that that lend themselves to TV.
Policy by Americans' Stupidest Home Videos. Slate's Dave Weigel, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I mentioned to Dave Weigel that new research suggests that reading scandalous news stories may actually benefit us, at least in some ways. Dr. Beth Miller is a political scientist who studies this. She teaches at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Beth, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So describe your experiment.
So in the study, participants were given a series of newspaper articles about a fictitious campaign, and those articles detailed the candidate's position on a variety of issues. And then towards the end of the study, half of the participants were given information about a candidate's involvement in a scandal. He basically confessed to an extramarital affair with a former aide, and the other half were not. And then towards the end of the study, participants were asked what they could recall from the campaign.
This was fake newspapers, fake candidate, fake stories, and so forth. But the policy issues were realistically dry, and the scandal realistically scandalous.
Exactly.
Okay. So you waited from 1 to 14 days to test the students' memories on the candidates' policies, right?
Right. The delay was a 1 to 14-day delay to ensure that students were just not remembering from working memory, but were actually pulling from long-term memory.
Obviously, the group that was distracted with the scandal stuff couldn't remember the policy issues as well.
No, the opposite, actually.
Explain.
So the participants in the scandal condition obviously could remember the scandal. But what was interesting about the study is they also were more likely to remember the policy-related information they had heard about the candidate than those who were not exposed to the scandal.
So this is really interesting because there are certain notions about memory. One notion suggests that the story would distract participants. But there's this other theory of memory that talks about associative nodes, right?
Right. The second theory or argument suggests that what scandalous information does is actually reinforce or activate previously stored information because people are paying more attention to the scandal, which means they're thinking more about the candidate. And because memory is connected and stored together, that activation or that extensive thinking also primes the previously stored information.
So the mere proximity of the scandal to the policy issues made the policy issues more memorable.
Right.
You mean that the media could be doing a truly pro-social thing by filling its newspapers with more scandals about these serious politicians who have serious ideas?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, actually. Scandals are beneficial in one way. They have a great side benefit, which is memory. But they're actually pretty negative for candidates. And they're negative in two ways. They're negative directly. The public doesn't like candidates that engage in scandal. But I argue in the paper that it has an indirect negative effect on candidates as well, because if I'm sitting there thinking about the candidate and I remember that we don't share policy preferences, then not only do I think he's a bad person, but I also don't like his policies, and so I like him even less than I would if he hadn't engaged in the scandal.
But what happens if you like his policies and you don't like his scandals? I think that one of our former presidents would come prominently to mind here. Do you suffer cognitive dissonance?
Not so much. A lot of the public is really great at ignoring things that are different than their preferences. And so when they hear that a fellow partisan has engaged in a scandal, they simply dismiss the evaluative implications of that scandalous information. So Bill Clinton does well among Democrats in 98, even though he's engaged in a scandal, because they still like the idea that we have an economic surplus and we're in good times. So not all candidates will suffer from scandal in the same way when there's positive policy implications for them.
Ultimately, you concluded, and I'll quote you here, that the depiction of the public as blind to anything but scandalous information seems to be an exaggeration. The results suggest that exposure to scandalous information may have beneficial side effects not previously explored. Some say that all the scandal has a kind of coarsening effect on the culture. Is that just another study?
Actually, I think that would be a great study. I was thinking today about the other side effects of scandal. I think with each additional John Edwards or Mark Sanford, the next politician is unlikely to be given the benefit of the doubt when the media says, hey, this guy engaged in a scandal. I've been exposed to so much scandal in the past. I'm willing to accept the media's account without a lot of scrutiny. And I think that's problematic for American politics.
Kind of reminds me of tobacco, supposedly very good for short-term memory, but not really good to be used over the long term.
Could be.
Thank you so much, Beth.
You're welcome.
Beth Miller teaches at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Speaking of political sex scandals, the congressional cat-footer du jour is Christopher Lee, a New York Republican who flirted with and sent a shirtless cell phone photo to a 34-year-old woman he saw in the personals on Craigslist. He said he was single. He said he was in his 30s. The woman learned he was lying on both counts and that he was a congressman when she looked him up on Google. So she leaked the exchange and the beefcake pic to Gawker. Lee resigned. The woman he messaged was later interviewed by The Loop 21, a local Black Issues blog. The Loop 21 asked, "What's the lesson in all this?" She replied, "The lesson is, if you're going to do dirt, do it anonymously. People cheat every day, but only dumb people get caught." Sound advice. There are certain things we would all rather not remember. Off a Craigslist, and it's not strictly platonic. I kissed a girl off a Craigslist. Don't knock it till you try it. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdurrahman, with more help from Andrew Parsons and Carlin Gallietti. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.